right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that was Let There Be Drums, and that's what we're doing today, sounding the drums around a very special topic. We're going to spend the whole hour today talking with the authors of a brand new book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. I had the chance to talk with the authors of this book just a couple weeks ago, and so I want to bring that to you this hour. In the summer of 2009, three hikers from the United States, Shane Bauer, Josh Vital, and Sarah Shord, were hiking in Iraqi Kurdistan when they unknowingly crossed into Iran and were captured by an Iranian border patrol. Accused of espionage, the three young hikers ultimately found themselves in Tehran's infamous Evin prison. Sarah Shord spent 14 months in solitary confinement. Shane Bauer and Josh Vital spent 2 years in jail. And just recently, the three hikers, Shane Bauer, Josh Vital, and Sarah Shord, wrote a book about their experience. It's called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. A really powerful book. And the three, Shane, Josh, and Sarah, are joining us today to talk about that book and about their whole experience. Shane Bauer is an investigative journalist and photographer. Josh Vital is a historian with a background in environmental sustainability. And Sarah Shord is a writer, educator, and contributing editor at Solitary Watch. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Yeah. You know, I want to jump into this because there's so much to talk about, and I know it could fill up hours, and I'm just sort of really, really want to find out what you guys went through, but also why it was so important in terms of what you wrote in this book. Now, I know you've done this a million times already. What happened? In your own words, you three went from adventurous hikers to political prisoners in one of the most horrendous prisons in the world, a prison that is noted for its cruelty and for the torture that goes on in there, and the generations of Iranians, both opponents of the government, revolutionaries from way back, the Shah tortured people in there. Yeah. You guys ended up there. How in the world did that happen?
It started with Shane and I. We were dating. We were both from California, and we moved to the Middle East. So we were living in Syria for over a year and had an absolutely amazing year. I was teaching Iraqi refugees. Shane was doing journalism. He'd already been doing journalism in the region for years. And Josh came to visit us after traveling abroad and working abroad. And we decided we wanted to go to a new place. Iraqi Kurdistan, unbeknownst to many people, is a safe part of the Middle East. It's not a war zone, and no American has been killed or captured there in decades. So we were with a fourth person, our friend Sean McFessel, and we spent days visiting castles, going to museums, and we kept seeing these posters of the green, beautiful mountains and waterfalls. So we asked about a good waterfall, a good place to go and hike, and several people recommended the same spot, Ahmed Awa. And when we got there, hundreds of people camped out. We really felt at ease. Our guards were down. Shane and I have both traveled in more dangerous places, and we took utmost precautions. Northern Iraq was, in 2011, Iraqi Kurdistan, it was on the New York Times top tourist destinations, top 41 tourist destinations in the world. What happened to us doesn't happen there. So someone pointed out a trail. We went hiking. Many hours later, we saw soldiers. And they motioned for us to come to them. And we later found out that the trail we were walking on was the unmarked border between northern Iraq and Iran. So they motioned for us to come into Iran.
Josh, you were kind of new to this.
I had never hiked along a border before. Yeah, and when I did, obviously not on purpose, when we found ourselves in Iranian custody, they immediately took us down the hill on the other side. And they took us to a police station. They questioned us. The guy wanted to see if I was American by asking me how to spell supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. It was immediately sort of absurd, but scary as all hell. And I remember when we left that police station, a couple hours of being in custody, there was a guy outside that police station who sort of went on this rant about what the American government had done to these Iranian diplomats. And I thought to myself, well, that's between the U.S. government and the Iranian government. That's a tension that I don't want to get involved in. Little did I know, this is a few hours into what turned out to be 781 days.
And Shane, for you, you had some experience as a journalist in the Middle East. And so you had some knowledge of sort of how dicey things can get in different circumstances.
Well, first of all, my guard was down, just like Sarah and Josh. I'd worked in Baghdad before, where you're kind of hyper aware of everything that's going on. It's very cautious, and worked in Darfur and in dangerous places, but this was not one of those times. So I wasn't in any way expecting anything like this to happen. You know, I have been in situations in the Middle East before where I've been detained, and journalists are generally kind of looked on with suspicion by governments in the region. But those situations, they never last long. And I thought that it would be clear pretty quickly that this was a misunderstanding. We never intended to come to Iran, and there was no real evidence that we would be entering Iran intentionally. We didn't have Iranian currency. We didn't speak Farsi. Sarah wasn't wearing a headscarf, which would have gotten us arrested immediately. And so I thought maybe, you know, a day, 2 days, 3 days, we'd be going back to Iraq. And they told us that they were taking us back to Iraq. But a few days into the ordeal, we were driven all the way across the country and brought to Tehran, where we were put in another vehicle, blindfolded, and driven into Evin prison.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with the three co-authors of a great new book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And we're talking with Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatale, and Sarah Shord. Well, there's something that happened. You went from something that seemed totally accidental to something that also seemed, at the same time, a kind of contrived thing. I mean, and it wasn't carefully contrived, but there was actually a soldier who was motioning you to come across. So you took this sort of step from accident to something else is up.
Well, I think it kind of snowballed pretty quickly. I don't think they expected us to be there. It was kind of a surprise for us and the border guards. But as soon as they called their higher-ups, they say, we have these Americans, then, you know, it goes up the chain. And next thing we know, we're being interrogated in the central prison, and the people in the top levels of government know that we're there, and it quickly became a political situation. I think for about a week, my interrogations seemed like they were trying to find out whether I was some kind of spy. And after that, it was very different, you know, started getting asked really absurd questions. And 2 months in, our interrogators told us that they knew that we weren't spies, but that our situation had become political, and that it was now between politicians in their country and politicians in our country, and we were basically just going to have to wait in prison.
And actually, while they may have said, okay, you're not spies, at the same time, you were political prisoners. Mm-hmm. Sarah, you talked a lot about how this ride from the border to eventually end up in Tehran was actually one that at each step of the way, the tension, the danger got increasingly higher. Can you talk a little bit about that journey?
Well, in those early days, it was very disoriented. We didn't know where we were. They were driving us through flatlands. It looked like salt flats. And we'd stop in different towns and, of course, couldn't read the signs because everything is in Farsi. The most important thing for us was not to be separated. That was my singular focus. So a few times they tried to separate Josh. They tried to put him in a different car. I think they saw two men together as being more of a threat. And something kicked in me, and I just started yelling at them. I mean, the idea of being separated was terrifying because, of course, we had no idea what was going to happen. But as soon as we arrived at Evin prison, we couldn't stop them. We were blindfolded. They gave us prison clothes, and then they just tore us apart. And that was the most terrifying moment where I couldn't delude myself into thinking that we weren't in something serious at that point.
There were a couple of days where we were held in a little jail in the countryside, and I remember that the jail was empty. There weren't people in it, but we found all these kind of notes hidden under the carpet, and it seemed that, judging by what was written on the walls, that there were Kurdish oppositionists that had been held there, and there were all these notes that seemed to be written to try to get messages to the outside, and we thought we'd be going back to Iraq soon, so we snuck these notes. We kind of tucked them into our clothing and thinking we'd be able to take these messages out, get them translated, maybe publish them. And then when we realized we're on our way to Tehran, and we just kind of panicked and tried to have them pull off and go to the bathroom and get rid of them.
I remember looking out the window and trying to find where the shadows were falling and what time of day it was, because it soon became established that the people who we kept asking, where are we going, and that we couldn't trust them. So we're just trying to figure, are we going north? Are we going east? Which direction? And so that was how we were orienting ourselves.
And there was that point where they had told you were going back to Iraq, and then you're trying to figure out, like, what the hell, man? This is not the direction towards Iraq.
Yeah, no, it was clear we were heading east, and that was a big strike against hope. That night that you referred to, we're driving in the dark, and this guy cocks his gun three times, and it's like, okay, well, this could be the end. And when he dropped us off at a county jail, I just remember feeling like, wow, I never thought I'd feel so happy to be thrown inside a jail and not be killed in the country.
Well, let's dig into this a little bit more. When you end up, you're in Evin jail, you're in the first jail, and I guess the first jail was a sort of lesser prison?
It was within the same compound of Evin prison. Okay. I think it was the area controlled by Revolutionary Guard.
And that's where the initial interrogations took place?
Yeah.
Let's talk about that, because these interrogations, there was a terrifying element to it. Even as you're sitting in there and you're not having your fingernails pulled out, metaphorically, you're up against some people who are convinced. Their epistemological method is, you're spies, and we're going to dig into your life to prove that.
Right.
So we already know the truth. We're just going to get the evidence. Yeah. Now, you know? But let's talk about how you guys went through that.
You know, I felt like a lot of that interrogation for me was them pulling out the facts of my life and trying to paint a picture out of that, that I was a spy. Meeting politicians in Baghdad that were connected to Iran, sneaking across a border into Sudan as a journalist. Another element to it was that I felt like I was kind of being taught that the truth didn't matter, that they were going to prove that I was a spy no matter what. I remember one time I was brought into an interrogation and my interrogator said, we're going to ask you a question today and you need to think very carefully about this question because if you answer it falsely, you could spend years in prison. And he asked about a friend of mine and he showed me an email that this friend had sent. And it was from the time that there was talk of bombing Iran under Bush administration. And this friend had sent out an email, a group email, saying, what should we do about this? It was kind of calling for people to get together and talk about protest. And it was so symbolic of how kind of twisted the situation was that I was telling them that this was us trying to stop our government from bombing you. And you're telling me this is evidence of me being a spy. Whenever I would present them something that I thought was countering their narrative, they would just say, well, this is just a cover. This is just more evidence that you're a spy.
And maybe in some ways there was more evidence they could use in their twisted way against Shane or even against Josh because he has family in Israel and he's Jewish. But it didn't matter. The story that they wove around me was that the reason I was teaching Iraqi refugees in Syria is because I was training them to be intelligence agents for the U.S. And they said they wanted me to draw a map of the Pentagon. And I said, I've never been to the Pentagon. And they said, but Sarah, you're a teacher. All teachers go to the Pentagon. It really, anyone could have ended up in that situation and they would have found a way in their worldview to convince themselves that we were guilty.
I want to talk to you about that, Josh, because there's a political truth going on where whatever's true is what they need politically. And then that whole thing of just bulldozing everything in that direction. You find a situation where, and you guys went through this too, Shane and Sarah, but Josh, you went through this in terms of one, just your background. When they asked you your name and you said Josh Felix, because you were aware of there was a price to pay if it came out that you were Jewish. And the thing is that you look at this and the way this is so much part of a dehumanization. Can you talk about that thing of sort of this political truth and feeling? Because here's the thing. And I was thinking about this. If somebody looked at my life, if I was sitting in a chair and somebody was looking at my life, they could find a million things that I'd be going, oh, damn.
Yeah.
Why didn't I take care of that before?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sarah, what are you doing with those pictures in your phone?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
So let's talk about that a little.
Well, I mean, I didn't know, you know, if they would treat me differently. My father grew up in Israel. He's born in Iraq, and he moved to the U.S., and that's where I was born. I didn't know if that would make me be treated differently. So I just figured, like, well, you know, I don't want to take any chances, and I hedged my bets, and I was saying, like, I'm Christian, and I wouldn't tell my whole name. It didn't last long. They knew I was Jewish pretty early on, and they actually made this decision not to put it in their media, which I think is kind of interesting and sort of not, I would think that they would have used that for propaganda purposes. You know, they really used the isolation that they had between us as a way to try to have power over us. And I mean, at one point, I remember he said, look, this is a really important question. Just tell us, were you a spy? Were you entering illegally for these sort of seditious purposes? And I said, you know, Shane and Sarah already confessed. For a moment, I was like, did they really? I hadn't seen him for like a few months, you know, what was going on? And of course they didn't. He was just trying to push me. And this way in which where I was born, who my parents are, and like, nothing that I did, you know, the fact that I'm, you know, protesting these wars and these U.S. government wars in the Middle East, those weren't what was important. What was important was really just, you know, things that they can pick out. You know, because I remember this one moment after interrogation, a while after interrogation, the interrogators would still come every now and then. And one time the interrogator came and he said, look, you know, I had to put in the report about you guys. And I said, well, what'd you say? You know, we're not spies. You know our lives better than anyone else. What'd you say? And he said, you know, I had to really dig into myself and think about what was important. I had to consult with my inner voice of what, how to be loyal to my country and my God. And it was a hard decision, but I'm sorry, guys. And I just remember thinking, like, as Shane said, truth does not matter.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with the three co-authors of a great new book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And we're talking with Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatale, and Sarah Shord. Let's kind of dig into this a little bit more, this question of the process of dehumanization and powerlessness that you confronted in that prison in many, many different ways. And maybe I'd start with you first, Sarah.
Well, in the early months of interrogation, my interrogator, he seemed like a pretty fair guy. He liked to see himself that way anyway. And in the early months, I believed him when he said we would go to court. And I believed that this process was going to end and that we were going to go to court and then we would go home. The day that he came in and told me, I was wrong, Sarah, you're not going to court. And if you do, it probably won't be a good thing. And I don't know what's going to happen to you. We had a lot of conversations about poetry and religion and faith. Looking back on it now, I think he was trying to make himself feel better more than anything by giving me extra books, trying in some ways to ease my isolation by talking to me longer. And of course, probably on some level trying to get information out of me, but I don't think he believed there was anything to get. But he said something like, maybe you're being tested. Maybe this is God's test. And I just turned it around and I said, maybe God's testing you. You're the one that's in a position of power here. You're the one that can do something about this, and you're just going to let it happen. And from there on, once it hit me that we could be there for a really long time, I realized that begging and pleading wasn't going to get us anywhere. And we started to stand up, and we started to kind of get a sense of our own power. There was a guard who used to always put my food on the ground and make me pick it up. And I got so angry at some point, I just decided to stop eating unless she would hand me my food. And that's a really simple thing. But to feel like you have to pick your food up on the ground makes you feel like an animal. It makes you feel debased. And the other guards made her hand me my food. And we all had experiences like that where we realized that unless we stand up and fight for our humanity, they're not going to respect it.
I think there was a basic way that people were dehumanized systemically in entering the political wards of Evin prison. As far as I could tell, everybody that enters is put in solitary confinement immediately, and at least through the course of their interrogation. So it's a situation where you're completely alone, and there's a desperation that comes immediately with that. And what I saw happening to myself was that I start really wanting my interrogator to come, because I needed that contact. I needed something that would make the time pass faster. And even when I would have these interrogation sessions, it was like this puzzle. You know, I'm every question they ask, I'm trying to figure out where they're coming from, how I need to answer it. And it's not as simple as just kind of answering truthfully, even though I'm innocent. It's like trying to figure out what they're trying to get with each question. And that was much better than being in the cell by myself. And being a political prison, they were very careful to isolate people and separate them, because these are people who organize. They're activists, pro-democracy activists, a lot of them. And in kind of atomizing people, they really break them down. You have nothing at first. And then you kind of go through this process where you start to be given little things. And in getting those things that you can't resist, you're much easier to control, because you know what it's like to have nothing. You're terrified of going back there. So you start to go along.
That does seem to be a process that they used on each one of you, particularly in relation to the good guard, bad guard. It is true. You're broken down. You're isolated. What about you, Josh? How did this impact you?
I feel like throughout prison, at different balances, there's always this dance between resistance, just pure acquiescence, and something totally different, and some sort of play, something else, way of coping. And I like to think about all the times of resisting, and other times I kind of got into the guard we named AK's face. We named him AK.
It's an exciting part of the book.
he's a butt kicker. This is his radio name. And but there's also, you know, so many countless days of, I remember it took me a while, but eventually I started thanking the guards when they'd give me my food. And I thought, like, well, why should I be thanking these? You know, I would never want to do this. But everyone else was thanking them. Okay, they give me the food. And I said, thank you. And there's just sort of like this daily acquiescence to the fact that you're a prisoner, you have nobody to talk to in solitary confinement, you're just in walls, and you need a little bit of contact and communication, and it's desperation. Then there's these moments of defiance that really can transform relationships for the better, because it's those moments, the moments of hunger striking for letters, that start getting us news from the outside. And then there's also these moments, these odd and rare moments where I found myself like playing volleyball for a point with the guards, or play wrestling with one of the guards, not antagonistically but somewhat friendly. And it's this sort of mix, is that balance that you can, trying to keep some humanity in it. And all of these are in some ways strategies.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with the three co-authors of a great new book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And we're talking with Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatale, and Sarah Shord. You said that the ways that you could find to show some kind of resistance to all of the demeaning, dehumanizing, and terrifying things that were going on against you, that you found small and big ways to actually to do this. The hunger striking was one thing where you actually were able to reclaim your humanity and insist on your dignity and stand up against this. And as you were saying, moments of resistance. But there were other ways too, even including, I was thinking about the ways that different people, that each one of you did different ways to keep this going in a certain sense, which is really essential when you're in a situation like that, because mm-hmm. you are, for all practical purposes, you're sitting there and you're thinking, I'm alone, I'm up against this. Or even when you two guys were in the same cell, all of you were confronted with this thing of, at what point do we say, no, I'm a human being and I demand to be treated as such? Sort of like what the Attica prisoners said when they rose up, you know, right. that we weren't mm-hmm. going to take this anymore. But you found all kinds of ways to do it, including growing things in your cell and other things. So,
well, it helped that we were around political prisoners. I mean, from the get-go, I remember one of the first letter exchanges I had with Zahra Bahrami, who became a good friend of mine in prison. She said, don't let them see your tears. And I thought, why not? Why should I hide the fact that I'm suffering? Why should I act tough? They should know what they're doing. But then it made sense, because if you're vulnerable to these guards, they can manipulate you so much more. Yeah. I mean, they're the small ways and the big ways, but the other women would always yell back at the guards. I couldn't understand what they were saying, but just the tone of their voice alone, I thought, well, that should be my tone.
Even the fact that you could do writing, that you could actually steal pens or mm-hmm. fashion pens and figure out ways to write. I mean, even the idea, look, reading this book and the amount of detail, you know, and I know I was going to ask you, were you ever able to recover all the notes that you took?
I don't know how many months it was after we got out, several months after we got out of prison, the Iranians sent all our books back to the Swiss embassy. We had hundreds of books. When we got out, they wouldn't let us take them. And the Swiss eventually sent them back to the U.S. And what we had done, we actually learned this by reading Nelson Mandela's memoir. He wrote a lot of that memoir while he was in prison, A Long Walk to Freedom. And he had somebody transcribe his writings to kind of microscopic writing, and he stuffed it into the spines of a book. So Josh and I started doing that with, we start keeping diaries with pens that we had stolen. But when we got those books back, they were all slit open and the notes were taken. There was one note, I think, each that we got back.
The etymology book and the Bob Dylan anthology had some notes stuck inside the binding.
Once again, proof of Dylan is something otherworldly. All right. Sarah, you said this point about it helped being around other political prisoners. I mean, again, this is one of the most notorious prisons in the entire world. It's a place where, under the U.S.-backed Shah's regime, so many people were just mercilessly tortured and executed. And then again, under the Islamic fundamentalist regime, they slaughtered many, many thousands of revolutionaries, communists, and other people fighting against the regime. You know, so you ended up in one of the world's biggest hellholes. Did you guys know what Evin prison was when you went in there?
No.
No.
No, I remember the first time I got a letter from my mom, and it was in an envelope, and it said Evin prison on it. And I looked at the guards and I was like, what's this Evin prison thing? And they couldn't believe it, that I didn't know what it was. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's notorious. Yeah. Everyone in Iran knows. There were political prisoners held there during the Shah regime and, of course, after the Islamic Revolution. And people are tortured there, hung there. There have been mass executions.
And particularly, it was really, I mean, the point of really trying to crush the revolutionary spirit of the Iranian people. One of the things that really struck me was the torture when you guys could hear people yelling and screaming, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and you knew that it was torture mm-hmm. and it wasn't something else. And then they had, a guard came back and told you, I think, that it was football?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, Rasavi.
And yeah, let's talk about that a little bit, because of your thoughts when you knew that people were being tortured like this in this prison.
Mm-hmm. That was in the early weeks of imprisonment, and I was still really trying to figure out the lay of the land. And I thought Rasavi was just so lovely. She used to whisper all these sweet things into my cell door at night before she went home. It's like she was comforting me. It was almost like she was singing little songs or saying little prayers. And she would just seem so gentle and kind and beautiful. And when I heard the screaming, and of course I'll never know what was being done to that man, but I've never heard anything like it. And I hope I never have to hear anything like it again. It's absolutely blood-curdling. And she came to the door of my cell, and I was mock strangling myself to say, is this man being strangled? Or was pounding my fist against my head, is he being beaten? And she had this big smile, like it was the funniest thing in the world that I was reacting the way that I reacted. And she said, you know, football. And when she said that, I knew that she was used to it. She was completely inured. This beautiful young woman accepted that that was happening to people in this place.
I remember a time after Sarah got out that Josh and I were in the far hall of the prison, and there was this man who entered the hallway, and he was just completely broken. I remember when he would walk down the hall, he would kind of groan. And when the guards would open his door to give him his meals, he would just scream. It was just like the closest way I can describe it is like when monkeys are in cages and they're like screaming frantically. It was like that. And the guards would kind of just like kick him and just kind of pick at him when he's walking down the hall. And one thing that happened is that I realized how kind of hardened I'd become at that point, because I would hear him, and at first I felt bad for him, and then there was this thing that was happening to me where I'd be reading my book, and I would just want him just to shut up, you know, because I wanted to be left at peace myself, and it was like I was angry at him. And then when I realized that, I kind of tried to pull myself out of that, and there was a time when the guards were beating him, and Josh and I got up and pounded on the door, and this guard came running, and he just was like, you know, what the hell do you want? Shut up. And we said to him, what are you doing? You know, what is this, Guantanamo? And he just was insulted. He was kind of taken aback, and they stopped beating him. Like, to them, what they were doing was still better than this idea that they had of this other prison, Guantanamo. And to think that what they're doing might be like that was terrible.
Mm-hmm. You guys, go ahead, Josh.
There was a way of coping that we had, and some of it was healthy and some of it wasn't, you know. And you know, we made alcohol in the cell. We dried it with fruit, and we
tried to make alcohol.
I was gonna say
I read more the like book, vinegar. Josh.
I think it had like 1 or 2% in it. And like 10% vinegar, but 1% alcohol. We grew that plant that you talked about. We fed a cat through the window and a bird. You know, we like tried to do things to keep ourselves a human spirit. We celebrated all these holidays, especially the first year with Sarah. But there's a line, and it's hard to figure out where that line is when it's like no more playing, no more games, no more acquiescence. You have to just draw it and say, okay, hunger strike, okay, we're going to bang on the walls until this happens, or bang on the door. And the figuring out of that line is really like a big process in there. And for us, as Sarah mentioned, it was Iranian prisoners that taught us, you know, where to draw that and how, what's okay and what's not. And also books, some of the books we got The Slave Narratives of Frederick Douglass, and he drew the line in his life against his slave master, and that changed his life. And so any inspiration that could make it through the walls to us could help us figure out that really tough question of when to put your foot down.
We're going to take a quick break, but before we do, I want people to get a chance to hear Sarah Shurd reading an excerpt from the book A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran.
Sarah. I suddenly hear a soft whisper. The voice is close, almost as if it were in my cell. Sarah. My head darts to the right and left, looking for the source of the sound. Am I imagining it? Sarah. The voice is louder now. Please. It seems to be coming from the corner near the door, where my sink is. Above the sink is a vent. The vent! As soon as the thought crosses my mind, I leap off my bare mattress, compelled by a force beyond my control, and climb onto the sink. I press my mouth to the vent. Who are you? I ask the voice. How do you know my name? My name is Zahra, almost the same as yours, Sara. I know you. You know me? I saw your mother on TV. I'm so sorry for you, Sara. I'm a mother, too. Did you talk to my mother? I almost yell, then remember to hush my voice. As soon as the question escapes my mouth, I realize how irrational it is. No, Sara, but I saw many pictures of you on TV. You're a small, beautiful full girl. I know it must be easy for you to be standing on the sink. For me, it is difficult. They beat me. They kicked me and tortured me. My hips hurt, and it's difficult for me to stand. I feel tears welling up in my eyes. It's a miracle, I think. She knows me. We can talk to each other. How is it possible that the guards don't know about this? I try to imagine her hurt and alone, being taken out every day for beatings and interrogation and then put back in a cage, separated from her children, her life, and her country. So much like me, I think. Yet as bad as my situation is, Zahra's is far worse. Why did they arrest you? I asked. It was at the protest, she said. Ashura. Suddenly, the door of my cell bursts open. A guard, small, voluptuous silhouette, is outlined in the doorway with her hands on her hips. She must have heard us talking and crept down the hallway, probably shoeless so we wouldn't hear her footsteps, and pounced on us in the middle of our forbidden conversation. It's like being caught masturbating by a ruthless schoolmarm, like discovering a private, secret pleasure, and then being exposed and humiliated. Not Layla, I think, of all the guards. I've managed to stay on her good side up to this point, and she's helped me. So much. This time my pleas have no effect on Layla. Her kind, motherly face slams shut like a steel door. She says she will tell my interrogators what I've done. Zahra, the new prisoner, is immediately transferred. Now when Layla comes to my cell, there are no more smiles, no conversations in Arabic. She hands me my food with a cold, unfocused stare, then wordlessly leads me out to the courtyard for a few minutes of sun. I'm no longer her Ukhti al-Aziza, her sweet sister. I'm a plant that she gets paid to keep alive.
That was Sarah Shurd reading an excerpt from the book A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran, which she co-authored with Shane Bauer and Joshua Fatal. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. All right, welcome back. That was Sons of Slaves from Matana Roberts. And we're going to jump right back into the interview we're doing with Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatal, and Sarah Shurd, the co-authors of a really good new book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. These are the three hikers that were captured by the Iranian government back in 2009 and held in one of the most infamous prisons in Iran for more than 2 years. So let's rejoin our interview now. Well, there's one thing, too, that really struck me, and I think it's extremely important, because you guys, coming out of the situation that you came out of, all of you were somewhat familiar with the world. You were familiar with different people in different parts of the world. And so it wasn't like, oh, my God, you know, like you were just thinking and thrown down in Iran and, who are these? But you had a sense of other people, other cultures. But the thing that was really important, I think, in all that was happening to you in the prison, you actually managed to maintain a certain understanding that the Islamic fascist regime was not the same as the Iranian people.
Yeah.
And it got expressed in a lot of ways. One way was, I thought, the idea that when you did hear torturing, that even the pounding on the doors was something that generated solidarity throughout the prison, which I thought was a really important stand to be taken.
Yeah.
But can we talk about that a little? How you separated off the Iranian people from the regime? Because that's a big point of struggle in the world today.
Well, I think it was just obvious when we were there. You know, there were times when, in the very beginning, that I broke down in my cell and people would call out into the cell to me, you know, and say, like, it's okay. Or I would walk down the hallway with my blindfold on and a guard would be behind me and I'd kind of tip my head up so that I could see under the blindfold. And there'd be people in their windows giving me victory signs and we'd whisper to each other. And it's like this constant support. There was just such a sense of solidarity in that prison amongst people and people reaching out to me, giving me news about my family, stuff they saw on TV. And the line there, it was clear, you know, it was like, we're on one side, everyone who's behind on one side of the door is on one side, and everyone's on the other side of the door is on another side. Mm-hmm. It wasn't about who's Iranian, who's American, or anything like that.
Sarah?
Yeah, I would definitely echo that the other prisoners opened up that door for us. I mean, I didn't know in the beginning, I didn't know that we were in a political prison for a long time. It became obvious. But at first I thought maybe the people around us will hate us. They'll believe all the lies their government is saying about us. But I couldn't have been more wrong. I mean, the first woman who talked to me, she did the V sign and then she made fists and she shook them and she was just like, you know, be strong, you know, wait. And it I don't know. If we'd been in a different prison in a different part of the world, it would have been very different.
Josh?
The Iranian guards, throughout the 26 months, they'd come to the door and they'd say, the ones who'd want to chat, they'd say, so what do you think of Iran? Like, kind of cheerily, like as if we're about to say we love the runners. He said, well, you know, I went to your border and I went to your prison. And everything in between is kind of a blur. And so I can't think of too many great things. And then they were kind of looking at me like, aren't you going to talk about our great ancient history and the beautiful country we have? But what I didn't want to tell them, because it was illegal, what we were doing was whispering to the other prisoners. And that there was a clandestine communication. There was a different Iran than the Iran that I was allowed to see from the border to the prison that is inspiring and is even visible in the least likely place, like prison.
I think there's some ways that Iranian culture is, it's obviously it's very old culture and very unique, but there's also certain similarities just throughout the Middle East. It's kind of a base culture, and it's always, from the first time I ever went to the Middle East, to the Arab world, it struck me how people, all kinds of people, separate this idea of government and kind of larger people. And I've never experienced animosity in the Middle East, in any country, just kind of walking the streets, being an American. And maybe that's because the difference there is very clear and stark, that governments tend to be very authoritarian. But I would never have thought that Iran would be any different in that way, and it wasn't.
And even the guards, I mean, on one, I can never respect anyone that chooses to work in a political prison. But the worst guards, Nargis and Mask Lady, it was clear that no matter how wrong, even if they were completely convinced that I was innocent, which I think they were, I mean, I don't speak a word of Farsi, it didn't matter to them. They were going to toe the line and support their government. They had no moral conflict. But a lot of the guards did have a moral conflict. Miriam, she seemed to hate the situation that I was in. She wanted to show me kindness, but she also had to enforce the rules. She had to lock me in a cage over and over again. But there was a certain level of respect between her and I. At a certain point, she wouldn't let me go out to the open air cell, and I was really angry with her, and she slapped me, and I slapped her back, and she let me go out. And I felt like she respected the fact that I was standing up for myself. And I felt that some of the female guards respected the other women there, too. I've always been curious about that. I'm not sure.
Let's talk about solitary, because this is, and Sarah, I interviewed you about this, so I'm going to let you hold off until the back part of it. But
sure.
Each one of you experienced solitary, and to varying degrees. And Shane, I'd start with you, because you made a comment which really, I was looking at it and I thought, wow, this is kind of heavy here. You wrote about solitary as an experience whose essential quality is its texturelessness. It's a big word, I can't say. It's texturelessness. You made that word up, brother.
Yeah, autocorrect. You never accepted that.
Yeah, right. As the slow erasure, and this is what I thought was very heavy, as the slow erasure of who you thought you were. You still think you are you, but you have no real way of knowing, since you have no one to reflect you back to yourself.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this a little bit, the experience of solitary.
The way that I kind of think about that experience of mine in solitary confinement was that I think of it as kind of an abyss. And when I first start trying to write about solitary confinement, I felt like I had this problem that you can't really draw an abyss. You know, you can draw the edges of it. And that's kind of the problem that you're faced with in trying to write about it or talk about it, is it's just, it's the closest you can get to nothingness in the human experience, I think, is you're just alone. You know, it's you and walls, and that's fundamentally inhuman. And there was a time after a few months in solitary where I start to wonder if I was going crazy, and I just kind of got tied in knots in my mind, because I didn't think there was any way for me really to know. I felt like to know that, I would have to interact with somebody and see their reaction to me, because it's a slow process, you know, these days move slowly. I'm slowly kind of, my mind is slowing down. I'm thinking less. And there were times that I'd be pacing my cell and then realize that I was talking to myself and not sure if that was a good thing or a bad thing, you know? It's like you're just stripped away of all context, and it's just you're floating in nothingness.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with the three co-authors of a great new book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And we're talking with Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatal, and Sarah Short. Josh.
Well, I remember when Shane and I were celled together. After 4 months, Shane and I were celled together. And I remember turning to him one of those first days where we were able to talk to each other all the time. I said, "Did you see the devil there?" And he kind of first looked at me like, what the hell are you talking about? But then I told him, you know, I sort of talked about my inner process, and he said that was, it was a similar thing. And for me, I felt like my mind just transformed from being sort of a friend and part of me to like my biggest enemy. And, you know, the future just became an object of fear. The past was just full of regret. And the present was just a bunch of walls and an unlivable moment. And I had to kind of remind myself, like, feel like my most intimate and imminent enemy is my own self, and I couldn't get away from it. But of course, it was the people who were locking me up, and I had to try to assert that as some sense of who I was. I feel like I had sort of read a lot of and done meditation and had a background in, you know, Buddhist and yoga, this sort of stuff before prison. And I remember feeling my mind just becoming blank and becoming thoughtless. And I thought, oh, maybe this is some sort of enlightened state. And then I realized, like, the moment I had some contact with the Swiss ambassador, or when Shane and I had a very brief clandestine letter writing correspondence, that my mind became totally uncontrollable. And it wasn't anything close to enlightenment. It was kind of the opposite. It was just pure, dull mindlessness.
Yeah, broken.
Broken.
Yeah. Now, Sarah, you spent the entire time, 14 months in solitary. And I remember when we talked a little while ago in the midst of the hunger strike here in California, the description you gave of that was just so, I mean, it was just so searing and, I mean, just incredibly powerful. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about that, because, I mean, people, I think people don't really understand, even when you look at, like, what happens in the supermax prisons in the U.S., and then you think about, okay, mm-hmm. and then you take it to the experience that you guys had, and in particular you, it's just unthinkable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's important what Shane said is that it's really hard to know what's happening to you while it's happening. It's only in hindsight that I've, through going back over it in detail and really writing this book was incredibly important for that I could understand and put words to the process. And also, once I was able to see Shane and Josh for brief periods, through them I could see myself. And most prisoners don't have that. So a lot of prisoners in solitary that I correspond with now or that I've met, they think they're kind of okay. And they don't know until they get out. If they get out, they'll never know just how not okay they are. Solitary confinement feels like a slow death. You lose contact with everything from the outside world. You can't remember I couldn't remember what my sister's voice sounded like. I would try to imagine my mother's face, and you get so frustrated with the limitations of your own imagination with no other stimulus. How can you actually make the ocean feel like a real thing that exists out there? I used to try to imagine the ocean, and if I could just get a little taste of it, I would be filled with joy. You get reduced to an animal-like state. I spent many hours a day pacing compulsively in my cell. Prisoners that I've written and met with here will pace the same pattern into their cell for so many years that the concrete wears away. I spent hours and hours crouched by the small food slot in my door just listening for sounds. If I could hear a footstep or someone cough, it helped orient me. It felt so much better and eased my anxiety. There were times that I lost touch with myself. My worst breakdown, I heard screaming and I just was crouched in the corner of my cell. I just wanted it to stop, and I put my hands over my ears and I thought, I wish that person would just stop screaming. And the guards burst into my cell and started shaking me, and I realized that I'd been screaming and that I'd beaten at the walls of my cell. So, I mean, broken prisoners are easier to control, and that's why solitary confinement is employed, I believe, in many cases. Either that, or it's just problem prisoners that nobody wants to deal with, mentally ill people. The only way to survive it is to find your inner resources, your strength, and stay human. Whatever it is that makes you feel human in that place is your only defense against those forces that are shrinking you.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with the three co-authors of a great new book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And we're talking with Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatale, and Sarah Short. When you think about it, it is 24 hours, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, torture. Nonstop. How can anyone look at that and say, oh, come on, it's not, you know, whatever. It's sort of, I just, your description of it is just really chilling, and I think really important for people to hear. I wanted to, I have a couple more questions if we can do that. When you're talking about this, I kept thinking about you eventually got out. And you guys, and I know that there was a constant playing of you guys, you know, like the guards, like, Josh, you're separated off and you find out that Sarah and Shane were able to talk to one another. Mm. Sarah, you find out that Josh and Shane are in a cell together. And there's a, and there's these things that constantly are constantly hammering. But yet the three of you really stood together. Now, you got out after 14 months and still you're very much broken still, you know, in a certain sense, not broken in terms of your will, your ideology broken, but in terms of the physical and mental impact it's, it had on you. But instantly, you went out and you started, you joined the campaign that had grown to very significant proportions all around the world, and you really fought to ensure that Josh and Shane would be released. There were a number of surprising people who came forward and said, okay, let's get into this. But there was also some things that I wanted to ask you about in terms of, I mean, you know, look, like Oman came in and really brokered a lot of the what was necessary to get you guys out of jail, including you, Sarah, but all three of you. But then I'd also like to ask you a little bit about this, because we've talked about the Iranian government, but the other side of the Iranian government, the role of the U.S. government in relation to all this, because there was some, I think, some very revealing things that happened as you guys really tried to push on what the hell is going on here.
Well, when I was released, it was very clear what my task was. I had a mission, and the Omani envoy, Salim Ismaili, told me the Iranian government has already given two good gestures. They let your mothers come and visit, and now they've released you. There's no way they're going to release Shane and Josh without something back from the U.S. And it can be something really small. It doesn't have to be a big thing. But Ahmadinejad, the president, can't put his neck out again and look weak unless he gets something back. So we put so many things on the table. At one point, a letter. There was a guarantee that Shane and Josh would be released if President Obama would write an innocuous letter to President Ahmadinejad saying, I hope that our countries have better relations in the future. I hope things, peace on earth will come, blah, blah, blah. That was a non-starter. They wouldn't even consider it. That letter was never written. Releasing Iranian students in the U.S. that have overstayed their visas, that could have done it. There is a woman that was imprisoned and her sentence was almost up, an Iranian woman whose husband actually committed the crime, but he got away and she got caught in his place. None of these things were even a question. So that's why we had to turn to other governments. You know, even the Omani effort, it was still dependent on getting a good gesture from the U.S. And we just didn't believe after a while that that was ever going to happen. So we went, Sean Penn helped me get in contact with President Chavez of Venezuela, who's very close with President Ahmadinejad was. And that phone call between those two presidents of Venezuela and Iran resulted in a promise that they would be released. The president of Iraq, President Talabani, played a very, very constructive role. So eventually, international pressure from many countries, public figures around the world, reached a tipping point. So the Iranian government realized they're getting diminishing returns on this investment. And if they don't cash it in now, you know, all is lost. And they just got tired of it, I believe, and let them go.
You guys have anything to add to that?
You know, Oman was... Iran decided to release us through Oman, and Oman was playing the negotiating role between the U.S. government and the Iranian government, and continues to do now, as we hear in the news. They were able to do that because of international pressure help, and that we were all released in different years at the U.N. General Assembly, so it was a PR stunt. But it became, you know, these gestures, these small gestures. Letter didn't work, but there were these other small gestures that pushed the, you know, that made this back and forth possible. And, you know, we were thrown in prison at this moment in American politics where Obama was 6 months in office, and there's like over three decades of hostility between the two countries. And the effort to move the two countries closer together, you know, which was one of his campaign promises, was, you know, for us, every day that that delayed was a day lost in my life.
I think that when I was in prison, the focus of my frustration was always the Iranian government. They could have let us go at any moment, you know. But I also felt a lot of frustration toward the U.S. government, you know, that we were there so long and it felt like they weren't doing anything to get us out. But I was kind of more frustrated with the kind of general approach, you know, of foreign policy towards Iran and the Middle East in general, you know, that I think that if we are dealing with countries with in such an aggressive manner, you know, sanctions that are impoverishing the country, interventions, CIA intervention in Iran and overthrowing their first democratically elected prime minister, we have to expect that there's going to be retaliation. And we were a means for Iran to retaliate against the United States. You know, they held us simply because we had American passports. And in the scheme of things, you know, for us, this was a big consequence. But in the scheme of things, it's maybe a fairly small consequence. But it's just an example, I think, of the much larger consequences that can come. And there's many people tied up in this. You know, there's Iranians who can't go home. There's Iraqis whose families have been devastated. We had friends who lived in Iraq that spent years in prison because they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. We're talking thousands and thousands of people, you know, that we're just three of.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned in to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with the three co-authors of a great new book called A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And we're talking with Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatale, and Sarah Shord. This will be my last question. Let me ask you this. It's, you know, going through the book, and again, I have to say how powerful it was and really deeply impactful. But at the end of it, one of the things that really got me, too, is that as we talked about, as I was inferring all along, is that you guys did not sort of crawl out and disappear. This changed you dramatically. And I'd like to talk about that from each of you, in what ways you were changed. And I know, you know, some of you have done the work around prisons and you know, I've read your work, Shane. You know, the stuff you did around Pelican Bay was outstanding. And Sarah, I've interviewed you. Josh, I haven't. This is the first meeting you, but I want to hear what changed for you and how you look at the world and what you feel compelled to do these days. So maybe we can start with you, Josh.
Almost like I was alluding to in my last comment, I feel like we were caught in this sort of historical problem in a way. I mean, the U.S. hostility for decades, this situation where Iranian resistance to American hegemony is this sort of irrational kind of authoritarian approach. And this way in which U.S. imperialism and then the response to that becomes this, you know, creates so much havoc for people like us. I just felt like when I was in prison, I spent days and days and, you know, reading and discussing with my friends, Sarah and Shane, about why are we here, you know, in all the different ways. And I ultimately feel like we're here because, you know, because of this bad history. And so, you know, my work now, I'm a student of history at NYU. I'm hoping to write, you know, another book one day and have this be exposed, because I think until, you know, we as a country can come to terms, not just with, you know, our current policy and towards different countries, but really owning up to what it's done in the past, we're, you know, we'll continue, people will continue to pay for it.
Okay. Sarah?
I don't think that my experience fundamentally changed me. I think more than anything, it raised the stakes. My belief system is the same, but when I hear about someone imprisoned, tortured, killed, it's not just a statistic. It's not just, it's a real human being. I can put myself in their position pretty easily. There's not a leap there. I think it escalated me on my path and gave me a focus. Solitary confinement is something very personal to me, and it's also very political. I work with Solitary Watch now, so I regularly engage with some of the 80,000 people that are in prolonged solitary confinement in our country on every given day. And their stories, I can relate to their stories because I've lived it. And I'm constantly in awe of people's resilience, the fact that people don't give up on life, that they find resources in themselves, that they, despite their conditions, in many cases become, like, deepen their humanity. Instead of becoming the monsters that they're being treated as, they refuse to become those monsters. So I really draw my inspiration from this work.
When we last spoke, you were working on a play. Are you still working on that?
Yeah, I've already, it's called Opening the Box. So we're going to, Solitary Watch and I are going to publish an anthology of writing from people in solitary confinement. And I'm also going to be producing a play, Opening the Box.
Oh, great. Shane.
When I got out, I felt like there was a period where I was kind of watching myself change. And it was like, I was just kind of observing it happen. And I mean, it was a lot of like little things, you know. I wanted to live in a comfortable home that never really mattered to me before. But fundamentally, I don't think that I changed that much. But I've been a prisoner, and I feel still very connected to prison. When I got out, my mind was still in prison for a long time. My body was out, but it was hard. I had to kind of still, it was a process to become free. And coming back to the United States felt wonderful. And it's, you know, I thought every day about it in prison. It's a place that I love very much, and more than anywhere in the world. And coming back here as someone who'd been in prison, it really drove home to me that we're a society that really values freedom outwardly. And we also have more people in prison than any country in the world. And that, I think, is a fundamental contradiction that we need to deal with. And I think that the rate of which we incarcerate people is going to define this time that we're in right now. And, you know, this isn't necessarily all brand new knowledge to me, but now kind of looking at this as a prisoner, it means something very different. You know, I know what it means to have your freedom taken from you and how serious that is. And so I've kind of, you know, for the time being, dedicated my time to really digging into this and this prison system, finding out why we're doing this, what the impacts are, and how we're treating our prisoners.
Yeah, and how to stop it. I mean, yeah. It's as you're saying, it's just unacceptable. When you have a country that, Sarah, you've mentioned this a number of times, the 80,000 people in solitary confinement at any given moment,
mm-hmm.
just, and that's 80,000 people undergoing the kind of torture we've been talking about. Yeah. This is just...
No. And we're talking about decades of some people. Yeah. I mean, there's people who've been in solitary confinement in this country for 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, yeah. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with three people who've become... Well, they're on the list, okay? It's not a long list. It's a short list of favorite people that I've interviewed. Right? We've been talking with Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatale, and Sarah Shurd. And we've been talking about their book, A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. And really, go out and get this book. Get about a dozen copies and just spread them all over your neighborhood, because people need to read this, all right? So Josh, Sarah, Shane, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today, Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatale, and Sarah Shurd. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson. I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Kermit Ruffins and Kermit's Second Line.